I would have to go therefore for somewhere like India, which is vast. And we lived in an old ramshackle house, not very far away from the British High Commission in New Delhi. And we used to drive in every morning, and it was fascinating. It was like being in a film set, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the colors.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips, how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. Tom Marchbanks is a super networker. In fact, he was a government-sponsored networker. Interesting. Welcome to the program. In my search for guests for this show, I've noticed there are clusters or camps of different types of business in the world. There's the big business, that is the household names and the companies that cross international boundaries. And then there are the big national companies. The mindset in all of these is different. The majority of people on this show over the last few months have been from one camp. They are all solo entrepreneurs, finding their way in the world and totally reliant on the internet and the connectivity that we all take for granted. But it wasn't always like that, and in some parts of the world, it has never changed. The physical meeting is still key. There's this area of business that is huge, and it is the realm of the national and the multinationals. But it needs governments and people to unlock it and guide the process. I'm talking about international development. This is the trade delegation business. This is where governments set up teams of fixers, people who will manage every aspect of the process. It starts at the top with politics, where a country is looking for a trade deal. It is people like Tom and his team who are in on the conversations from the beginning. They support the negotiations, and at the end, they are there supporting the companies, getting the contracts and doing the business. This is networking, but it's far removed from my business experience. Most of my connections are solo entrepreneurs. All right, we're okay at networking, and some of us struggle with the face-to-face stuff, but that is because in the digital world, we're used to social platforms breaking the ice and starting the process. But that is the point. To network means to build a relationship with someone. It means making a connection. I tell clients all the time, they're going to know, like, and trust you before the business can begin. But put that into a different culture where religion, customs, weather, and politics all play their part. It is a completely different story. Tom Marchbanks has been a civil servant most of his working life. He's worked for the Scottish government and the UK governments. He's been based overseas in places like India, China, and more recently the Middle East. This is an interesting time for our conversation as Tom sets out on a new career as an independent trade and investment advisor. This interview is an insight into his world, but as with all my conversations, I'm more interested in the man and not just the job. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Tom Marchbanks. Welcome to Life, Passion and Business, and another fantastic day in the Scottish Highlands. It's beautiful and fresh and sunny here today with lots of frost on the cars, so it was a bit challenging this morning. I am so delighted to be in contact today with Tom Marchbanks, who is a contact I met through LinkedIn. And I understand he's been involved in overseas development or something on those lines. So we're going to explore that in a moment there. So Tom, thank you for taking the time out to be with me today.
Good morning, Paul. Good to be here. And thank you for the invite.
Yeah, it's great. Great. Whereabouts in the world are you? Are you in Scotland today?
I am, yes. By looking out the window, I can clearly tell I'm in Scotland. It is tipping down outside. It's pretty miserable, which contrasts terribly with the day we had yesterday. It was absolutely beautiful. I went out for a run. It was so nice yesterday. Yeah, I'm in Alloa in Clackmannanshire. And yeah, it's not very nice.
Oh, so that's the lowlands, isn't it, by for us Londoners.
Absolutely, yeah. It's in the east. It's kind of pitched between Edinburgh, which is further south in here, and Stirling, which is just a fraction further north in here. But it's on the east coast, right by Grangemouth Terminal.
People okay, might. So that's why you get the. That's why, because it's all drop. All that water is dropping down from the north east here. So you're getting that.
Yeah, you shunt all your rubbish down here. Quite right, Paul. Yes.
So Tom, look, as I said, we met on LinkedIn, and we haven't really had that much of a conversation. I know we have got a very noisy line, so hopefully we can cope with this over the time. So tell me, Tom, what's your story? How did you get to be doing this now? What is it about for you?
It's interesting. I didn't start off doing economic development. So international economic development is my kind of sweet spot. I've been doing it for over a decade and a half, and I've done it in markets all over the world: South America, the Far East, the subcontinent, and most recently in the Middle East. I didn't start doing that. I started working for the civil service. I went to the largest employer out of school, which was the Ministry of Defence, and really kind of just seized the opportunities as they arose. I spent 2.5 years at sea supporting the Royal Navy in theatres overseas, which was a remarkable experience for a young man and one I enjoyed immensely. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's got a shelf life, and I was getting married and eventually had to leave. And then we just kind of explored travelling and grabbed opportunities through the civil service to do the jobs that I've done. So I've led international delivery teams in the markets that I've outlined previously. And I've realized it's immensely rewarding to be able to help UK companies, and more latterly, specifically Scottish companies, to expand their businesses internationally, not just to see them succeed internationally, but realizing that there's a huge net gain to the country. As these people export their goods and services, they create more jobs, that creates wealth, that filters down, percolates down throughout the rest of the local economy. And I can see that in places like Glenrothes and Fife. I worked with a company whilst I was in the Middle East who were doing great stuff in the oil and gas industry. And they've taken on an extra 150 people in the last 5 years as a result of their exporting work and the work that Scotland's government has been able to deliver to these people. So it's been a realization that through interacting with companies, you can have a real benefit to the companies and to the local economy and to the economy of the UK as a whole, which is fabulous.
What kind of role is that, though? Because it's like, you know, effectively you work for the government, or you worked for the government. So are you kind of the person that brings people together? How does it work?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. It's a kind of facilitating role. So I no longer work for government, but when I was working for the government, I headed up the trade and investment teams. People may recognise the brand of UK Trade and Investment. It's now the Department for International Trade. I worked for them in all of those markets except the Middle East. I'll come back to that in a second. And I headed up teams, delivery teams, international delivery teams, who really were consultants. I would consult with companies to work out what was the best market access strategy for those companies, talking about channels and talking about strategy.
So it's like you went into the company to identify what they could offer, and you also went out to the countries to find out what they needed, sort of thing.
Well, I was based in those countries, so they there was a kind of conveyor belt, to call it in a quite crude terms, of companies coming out to market that we would be working with back in the UK, and then they would come out to our teams, my teams, in those markets, and we would work with them to make connections for them, to open our networks to them, and to then allow them to build their own commercial business with those networks we put them in contact with. There was a nice circularity to it, yes.
Yeah, that sounds okay, right, yeah. So that's kind of, yeah. I can see what you mean now. Yes, because they would come to you, and you say it sounds like a good conveyor belt system. So that's clever.
Hmm.
And so, was that driven by the governments in those countries, or was that driven more commercially?
Well, it's a very good question. Actually, it was driven largely by the UK government and by companies looking for assistance in overseas markets. So the UK government, as I say, through UK Trade and Investment, which is now the Department for International Trade. And in Scotland, that Scottish Enterprise and their overseas brand is Scottish Development International, who I spent the last 4 years with in the Middle East. The companies, those organizations are there to help those companies into those markets, give them a foothold, helping them do research, helping them understand the market, helping them into the market, taking them to market for market visits, and then opening up networks and connecting with people, with partners, potential partners, joint venture stakeholders, that kind of thing, that can help them build their markets overseas. So it's really the host government that starts to build that. However, I think what we will see going forward, and here I mentioned the B word, as a result of Brexit, we will probably see more of a demand from other markets. So for instance, African markets, where hitherto we've just been a little skeptical and we've probably chosen to do business in other markets such as China and India, Brazil, Russia, maybe not so much Russia latterly, but you know, I think we will see more of a drive from African markets to connect with companies delivering goods and service. And so we're going to need to be that bit more ambitious and that bit more, or that bit less risk averse in dealing with those types of markets. So I think we will see more of a drive from the governments of those markets that we've hitherto not been fully engaged
in. I mean, historically, they've been very dangerous places to do business in.
Yes, I think when you say very dangerous, I mean, I spent quite a bit of time travelling back and forth to West Africa.
Well, so I know just, Nigeria. I wasn't thinking necessarily, I mean, physically dangerous they are in places, but also is that there is so much corruption in some of these companies.
Absolutely.
Trying to find a company you can actually trust and do business with is actually quite a challenge.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It I mean, there's no doubt about it.
We've all had the letter from the Nigerian prince looking to offload his assets.
Yeah, I bet you didn't know you had relatives in Nigeria. How about that? Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. Yeah, the famous 417 scam, it still exists. It's got a bit more sophisticated, but it's still a scam. And you're right, those markets are very challenging. But I think I think what we also need to remember is those markets have developed, as well as the sophisticated scams. The actual market themselves have developed. And to give you a perfect example of that, I'm a non-exec director on the board of a software company, a Scottish software company, and we are in the midst of a transformational deal with a West African market that really will transform the company's business, but also transform the way that the education sector in West Africa deal with the marking of papers. And it's quite exciting because it sells the concept of veracity in their marks, you know, because there's a huge scandal, obviously, if you're in a Nigerian university, how do we know your degree has been gotten the right way? How do we know the kind of the truth in your marking system? So this software helps those countries and universities get a kind of pretty much 100% or as close as you can get to that marking system. So there's experience there where we see these markets are seeking out and reaching out to markets like our own, like England, Scotland, the UK and Europe, to do business with those, you know, with smaller companies there. And smaller companies are taking more of a risk in doing that. So it's, I'm seeing that.
I suppose I'm thinking about it, and it's not that I didn't think about this, but it just occurred to me from having this conversation, is that the things that we take for granted in the West per se, or in the first world, these things actually do exist out there. You know, exam marking papers does happen in African countries. And it's not, and you're right, there does need to be some integrity in that process. And there must be loads of processes that happen out there that already happen here that we just take for granted, but someone has to deliver them.
Quite. And we are seeing, I mean, when I say we, again, I'm referring to my role with this licensing software company here. And I think we're seeing that in financing and in insurance sector and in the healthcare sector and the way healthcare is delivered in those markets. They are getting increasingly sophisticated because as people get wealthier in those markets, they are demanding a better level of service. So it's a kind of inevitability that, as I say, when I traveled up and down to West Africa 20, 25 years ago, it perhaps wasn't there, but we're now seeing that today. And I think as we, you know, we need to capitalize on it, and we need to be mindful that these countries have developed in the 20 or 30 years and, you know, and be braver about investigating what those markets have to offer.
Fascinating opportunity. So what took you out of the civil service? Because you're now independent, aren't you?
Indeed. I've just, or I'm in the process of setting up my own independent consultancy. I guess you get to a point where working for government organizations, it's been a lot of fun, and I've seen a lot of the world, and it's been fantastic. But it comes to a point where you can't sustain that level of excitement and awe, and government machinery has to move on and it has to develop. And so I believe that the kind of things I've seen, the experiences I've gained and the insights I've got is better deployed by actually engaging with government from the outside, if you will. And that's one of the things I'm seeking to do, is to engage with, for instance, the new Department of International Trade and Investment, which is headed up by Minister Ivor McKee, and look at the way that they are trying to develop and restructure some of the delivery mechanisms that are in there. I've been talking to Russell at the Scottish Business Network, and I know Russell's very keen on this too. And so together, we're kind of looking at how we can help that process along and perhaps bring something different, fresh thinking to how that is done. And obviously, I'm looking beyond that. I'm currently discussing with a client in the Middle East about helping them with their foreign direct investment strategy, looking for companies to get into the Middle East. And so there's a number of different avenues that I can choose to do, but I couldn't do that if I was working for government. So the time is right. I guess you get to a certain stage of maturity in your career where you think, okay, it's time for something different. You need to be a bit brave, of course, and so I'm being that. But yeah, it's quite exciting at the same time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So obviously you've had this trajectory which allowed you to do travel, allowed you to do all these things. Where is your passion in all this? What is it that drives you about all this?
I think if you had asked me that 25, 30 years ago, I wouldn't have been sure I'd be able to tell you. It was just, you were young and you heard of these far-flung places, Caracas in Venezuela, and you thought, wow, that sounds really exciting. I'll go and visit that. What you learn from having done all that, of course, is that these places are hugely different. They have hugely different cultures, different language, different ways of trading. They have a different climate, of course, but fundamentally, people are the same. You know, whether they look different is one thing, but actually, underneath it all, they all want the same thing. They want family, they want security, they want a roof over their head and the lights to turn on at the click of a switch. It's, you know, there's a fundamental similarity. So what drives is being able to see those things, understand those things, and then bring parties together, realizing that, you know, we're not very different from the Indian, the masses in India. We all strive for the same thing. Now, we're worlds apart in terms of our markets and how we have developed over the years. And those markets are starting to catch up. It will be some time before they do that. But fundamentally, people are the same, no matter where you are. So what drives me, I think it's a desire to see those things. It's a desire to realize that we are fundamentally the same, and to think that if we do the right things together, actually, we can all benefit from this.
So has there ever been any challenges in that journey for you?
Yeah, huge challenges. I mean, you don't ship out with a family to the other side of the world without there being challenges. I think the challenges have been getting used to cultures, you know, getting used to the different ways and mores of a market. Living in the Middle East for 4 years was hugely fascinating. It was very difficult actually to get used to the it's not 9 to 5, it's 7:30 till 2:30. Of course, in a Muslim culture, things operate very different, not least it's a Sunday to Thursday kind of culture. So you realize, or what I learned there, is you need to kind of build that in. You need to sync your week with the UK, with Scotland in my case, because I was working for SDI at the time. So learning those simple lessons are lessons that others who want and aspire to trade in the Middle East need to learn too. So it's understanding there are small differences, but when you add them all up, it can be a huge difference. So the cultural differences, and just actually getting to grips with a different market. You know, the temperatures out there, particularly in the summer, were absolutely crippling. I mean, very, very humid, very, very hot. How do you deal with that? So you have to learn different ways. So you're like relearning every 3 or 4 years. you relearn a different way of coping. So yeah, massive challenges. And moving house, you know, packing up everything into
200 boxes. There must be some interesting stories in there somewhere.
There are things that got lost, things that we've never found, things that we've never actually had. I didn't realise we had that. So it can be a real adventure unpacking when you get to your next destination. But yes, so all of that is quite challenging. And of course, kids' schooling, moving schools, and but they've learned immensely out of this. They have friends now in other parts of the world, and keep, but the wonders of modern technology, they can keep in contact with those friends and find out what they're doing, what they're up to, which is great and super for them. It makes them, I believe, better, more balanced individuals. So there's a real upside to all of this, and that's the truth in all of this. The upsides are far, far more than the downsides, and you've got to embrace that and go with it.
So it's all very well for you as someone that's done all this stuff. I mean, someone who's actually looking to export or think to another country, there's a big steep learning curve if they're going to go out there and do it, isn't there, in a way?
There is and there isn't. It's obviously very contradictory, but I think as a company, if you're sitting in Scotland and you're thinking, right, I need to get another market, I'm starting to outgrow this one. You could be born international, of course. If you're a digital company, the chances are you're going to be born international. It's maybe less of a risk. But if you're someone who makes goods and your market here is getting saturated or it's slowing down, that you're looking to go overseas, clearly that's a massive challenge. But when you break it down into the component parts, there's a journey to be had. And that journey starts inevitably with a degree of research. And you can do lots of research sitting on your laptop or your iPad, and that'll get you a little bit on the way. And then you need to engage people. Obviously, talk to someone like me, talk to the Scottish Business Network, you talk to SDI or the DIT, and then you start to move further down that pathway. At some point, you will need to go to the market. And I think this is where the risk starts to spike a little, because that has a time and cost implication for companies, and they're reluctant, particularly if you're a small company, you're reluctant to move away from your business even for a few days to go and explore a market. You know, there could be thousands of, well, inevitably there will be thousands of pounds of cost in that. Sometimes you can offset that with grants you get from the government to travel, but perhaps not. You need to be brave enough to say, well, what is it worth to my company that in 2 years' time I start to export 60% of what I manufacture and my turnover doubles? That's got to be worth saying, well, that's worth X amount of time and money at the outset to go and do it and be brave and put that on the line and make the commitment to do it. And it's that commitment word that can be quite challenging when you're comfortable in a market that's doing okay.
There has to be a sweet spot for the size of a business or the amount of the value of a product or those bits and pieces that make it work. You know.
Yes, it does. You've got to be sensible about finding the right market. I mean, experience tells me that some companies I've experienced just sort of wake up one morning and see the rain and think, you know what, I know Dubai's sunny, I'm going to go and have a look at that market. And yes, it could be as fundamentally obscure as that. But you have to find out, you know, where in the world are buying your things. And for instance, Scottish Textiles, it's a great, great example. They're building massive hotels and have been in the Middle East for the last 4 or 5 years. And indeed, over in Qatar, they're flinging out hotels as well as they head towards the World Cup in 2022. Scottish Textiles are renowned the world over and clad the inside of some of the most iconic hotels in the world, in the US and I believe in the Far East. There's a great market for Scottish Textiles in the Middle East too. So it's doing that kind of fundamental research. I know that because I lived and worked there and I know what that market looks like. And you know, when I was head of the team over in Dubai, we had great networks that we could plug people into, specifiers who would be able to advise and hopefully specify Scottish products into the hotel building programs. It's having that insight, or it's knowing who to go to get that insight. It's knowing that that helps there. And that's a challenge when you're, as I say, a small Scottish company sitting here in the rain. How do you connect that piece to the piece of the market that, you know, there's someone there who knows what the market might look like for your product and who the right people to connect you are to develop that? And yeah, that's a challenge. But yes, you need to make those connections and you need to do your homework.
Yeah, and I suppose it's got to be something which you can. I mean, if it's a product abroad, what says that a local product, will compete with yours? Because yours is always going to be more expensive than a local product. So it's got to be something pretty unique about it to make people want it, isn't there?
Yes, I think, again, talking about the Middle East, and indeed China to a maybe lesser degree, and again, talking about textiles, if a hotel, you're talking about the hotel chains here, the Hiltons of the world, and those of that ilk, they're not going to put shabby product in their hotel. You're not going to get copycat product that's going to last a year and they need to be refurbished. You want the best, the stuff that endures. And Scottish product has that kind of history and legacy behind it. It does endure. It's an enduring product. So those big chains want the best. They're prepared to pay a price point that's probably a little higher than some fake rubbish because they know it's going to last that bit longer and they have a reputation to uphold. So, they're not going to mess around with that. So it's a fair point. You need to understand market dynamics and who's buying and what are they looking for over the life cycle of that product.
You sound like you've got quite a wide experience in terms of business experience, in terms of marketing or other kind of disciplines. Would you like, is that true? I mean, are you a very broad business experience?
I think that's fair. I wouldn't classify myself as a specialist in any domain. The roles I've done as head of international trade teams, when people are going out and having conversations, your team are going out and having conversations with companies, those conversations can be at the very start of the journey. Those companies might have done a little bit of research and might be on their first market visit. So your conversation will be calibrated around what their needs, what their immediate needs might be, what a midterm plan would look like, and then longer term outcomes. But you have to be able to have conversations all the way down that pathway, all the way down that journey, to be able to be credible. So what I've learned over the decades of doing this is exactly that. You pick up a different set of experiences and insights that help companies at different stages of their journey. And that's the key. So, yeah, I wouldn't call myself a jack of all trades, but I've experienced a lot along that pathway right from the very beginning, from the kind of light bulb moment when a company decides that it's time to export, right to the very first shipment, when a shipment comes out and lands on the quayside, what happens next, and then how to develop that beyond that first sale. So yeah, I've been very fortunate. I mean, I've made my own choices and to some degree made my own luck, but I've benefited hugely from it. And I do have a kind of very wide range of understanding and insight across that whole journey.
Fascinating. So what's been the fun bits for you? I mean, has there been anything that stands out for you that's been really enjoyable? Or, what would be, what am I looking for in this video? There must be something that goes, that's funny about these things. Because it sounds all very business-like and very solid. And I said, no, this doesn't work that way. There must be some things where you go, this went wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, as working for the government, you end up dealing with quite a lot of high-level visitors. So I stood at New Delhi Airport at 10 o'clock at night, waiting on a jumbo Tony Blair coming in with not all, but most of his cabinet and a whole host of others. And, people rolling off a plane at 10 o'clock at night, getting them to the hotel. Alan Johnson, when he was the Minister, the Secretary of State for Trade and Investment, this is going back to, I think it must have been 2003 or 2004, perhaps. In fact, I think it was the beginning of 2005. They all came off the plane. I was in the car with Alan Johnson and one or two others. Digby Jones was the other chap I had in the car. Took them to the hotel, dropped them off, only to have Alan Johnson say, blast it, I've left my glasses on the plane. So it's it's into rescue mode, and obviously you've got a couple of numbers to call, and eventually the glasses turn up at the hotel about an hour later. In that intervening hour, however, we sat with Alan Johnson, and he had remarkable stories about some of his parliamentary colleagues. Not nasty stories, just insights that you would never imagine. For instance, he could tell me that Gordon Brown had, you know, I think lost his eye during a rugby. We're talking about rugby, and he said Gordon Brown had lost his eye during a rugby match years ago in Scotland. Now, that's some things you never, you might not want to know that, but I found that particularly interesting at the time. And blimey, so there's these little insights. You get these little nuggets that come out of things, and things don't, you know, there's lots of things that don't go well. Car's not turning up, and you've got a grumpy Peter Mandelson standing beside him moaning that his car's not there. You know, it's there's all sorts of stuff like that that can happen, and fun too. But you're never really off the clock. You've always got to be on the clock and make sure things happen.
I guess I hadn't realised it was that kind of hands-on a process that you were doing. I mean, obviously, you're working with high level government people as well as everybody else, I guess.
I think that's the great skill that someone in those positions has got to have. You've got to be able to modulate your approach and have a very wide ability to converse about a wide range of things, not just about work, but obviously the political sphere as well. And it was at the time exceptionally exciting because you soaked up an awful lot and were able to reflect that back. And it was hugely enjoyable. And there was a lot of fun. I think that your point to what was fun, there was fun bits sprinkled throughout all of that career. And I'll still remember, as I've just recalled there, you'll still remember some of the funnier, the lighter moments. But yeah, you were always on the clock. It was always about business, but it was fun at the same time.
So what is success for you? Because I mean, you know, we were sold this model, and to some extent, you exemplify the model because you obviously left education, went into a good solid job, and then you have followed this path through. And now you've broken it because you're supposed to wait till you retire. You're not supposed to go and do things on your own.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I could have done that. I could have chosen, when I came back in the latter part of last year, I could have chosen to do that. But instead, I had an offer to go and work on a short assignment in Saudi, helping the Saudi government to build out their inward investment program as part of their Vision 2030. I took that opportunity, and then that finished. And really, since the earlier part of this year, I've been thinking, well, what next? But it was that desire, that there's still that desire to do something different. Whilst I'd rather not ship the family overseas again, I think we've kind of done that, and the boys are getting to that age in their schooling where exams are starting to loom, so I don't want to do that. But from a personal perspective, and I know my wife shares this feeling too, that, you know, there's still an adventure in there, and I'm still up for it. So I didn't think I was going to continue to have the ability or the chances, the opportunities to continue that adventure whilst seeing out my time, as it were, within our organisation and doing some great work, no doubt. But the adventure had just stopped at that point. So I thought, well, now's the time. I have preached for long enough about companies to be bold and be brave and do the research and get off the behinds and go and do it. Well, it's about time I started to take some of that of my own medicine, as it were. And so that's what I've been doing. And it's hard, you know, it's really quite tough trying to kind of build your own business and look at where the clients might be and what you can offer them. So, but yeah, I think it's just that challenge thing. It's almost in the DNA and you can't stop it. So yeah, let's see where I go with it.
So what is success? What does success look like? Is it money?
I've never done anything for the money. I think as you get older, and obviously when you've got a family, you need to keep a roof over their head and keep the lights on, keep the heating on. But it's never been about the money. The decisions I've taken, whether it was to go to sea or to India, or to China, or to Venezuela, or to the Middle East, none of those decisions were driven by money. I worked for the civil service, for Whitehall government or for the Scottish government. So it was never going to be about the money in any case. But I guess to do stuff on your own, it's about adding value. I want someone to say, that guy, Tom Marchbanks, he really does know what he's talking about. He really does have great networks and he's valuable. And it's in that value that we've been able to do X, Y, Z and grow the business and employ another 10 people. That would make me very happy to be an absolute integral part of that growth. That would be enough for me, to be honest.
Yes. So it's about outcomes for you by the sounds of it.
positive outcomes, employment for local communities and companies who are growing and taking on more people. Absolutely. It's about seeing that and knowing that I had an absolute part to play in that, yes.
It's interesting. I just want to pick up something you just said about, you know, about being being in the civil service is not exactly necessarily a well-paid role. But when you go abroad, how much of that do they support? I mean, obviously, you've got to have somewhere to live. Do they provide that?
Oh, don't get me wrong. Yes, you were always well looked after. I absolutely no qualms at all about that. And you're right. Yes, housing was paid. Obviously, the same model as you had here. You were never disadvantaged. So whatever you enjoyed in the UK, schooling, healthcare, that was provided. A house was provided, or a flat, depending where you were. And security was often an issue that determined where you lived in certain markets. So yes, things were provided. You were looked after. But you were never paid the vast sums of money that you see some expats being paid, the huge packages that, particularly in Dubai, despite the downturn in the UAE and across the Middle East, there are still incredible packages and people earning huge sums of money. And you can see that by the cars they drive and what they do with the money at the weekend. So, yeah, it wasn't of that magnitude, but it was enough to, you know, you never wanted for anything.
Oh, well, that's the, yeah. Okay. It makes you wonder kind of how that all works. And I guess, yeah, it's fascinating to hear the insight, the backstories of it. Hmm. So we've covered success, we've covered passion, and it sounds like your success and passion are quite intertwined, actually, in a way, because it's like you seem motivated by that. Have you ever lost your passion for stuff?
I think when I finished in Dubai, I think realizing that I was no longer going to be the head of a team who were delivering fantastic things for a range of Scottish companies. I mean, my team and I had been responsible for helping Scottish food and drink exports to the Middle East, you know, not quite double, but, you know, grow very quickly. I mean, that's a fantastic thing to be able to sort of put your hat on. Yeah. And realizing that you're coming back to be part of a bigger machinery and your light will shine less dimly didn't quite fit. And that was one of the reasons I took the opportunity to go out back to the Middle East, back to Saudi, with another company, because I thought, well, I kind of want to be in the center. I want to be shining brightly and delivering. So you kind of, yes, I think when you finish overseas appointments, and with any government, they tend to be 3 or 4 and very rarely 5 years, you tend to run into the buffers a little bit and think, what now? And you need to then seek your next fulfilling role. I remember when I came back from China, but it was difficult to see where that was going to come from. And then lo and behold, I morphed into the China export for the Regional Development Agency in the West Midlands at that time, a company called Advantage West Midlands. And I spent every 12 weeks traveling back and forth to China to help them build their inward investment pipeline from China. And that was probably one of the most rewarding roles I've actually done. But in between finishing in China as the head of the trade and investment team in southern China and that position, there was a gap of about sort of 10 months. And you know, I really didn't know what was forming. So there was a...
If you're working with does that mean you're out of work for that 10 months? Or you actually,
you're
just pushing paper on the desk for 10 months? And what does that mean?
Yeah, you're kind of in a holding pattern. I would liken it to being on the shuttle from Glasgow or Edinburgh down to London. And you're in the holding pattern just flying around and thinking, when the bloody hell am I going to touch down here? I'm running late. So it's that kind of sense of a lack of fulfillment. You know, when you do a job for, like I've been doing whilst I was working for the civil service. So those 3 years, you're very, very focused. They're very concentrated in delivery. They're high intensity, very active jobs. You're often working at night. Sometimes that can be late. Sometimes that can be 3 or 4 nights a week. And then all of a sudden someone turns the tap off and you kind of slide into oblivion and there's a fear factor there. So how do you recreate that again? Well, it's very difficult to, and I guess I've been a bit lucky there too. But at the end of the day, I've kind of made good choices along the way and picked something up and it's led to the next thing. So whilst I wouldn't say I've lost passion for things, there have been moments after that kind of appointment where, yeah, you go into the doldrums a little bit and you have to pick yourself up.
That's not necessarily a loss of passion. It's a bit like the performer that produces, or you know, the musician that produces the number one record. you know, which stays at number one for months and months and months. You know, will they ever achieve that again? You know, it's that feeling. Or will I ever write another bestseller? It's those feelings, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose you could liken it to that. I think I've more of a feeling of that now, having, you know, moved away from government and having moved away from mainstream corporate and now setting myself up as an independent consultant. I really have a sense of that now. I feel I've got so much to give. I've got stacks of experience of many different markets and different cultures, and I really want to utilize that for somebody's benefit. Somebody's got to see benefit in that. So I have a sense of that now. Will I have another number one?
So you have the biggest challenge now, like every consultant has, because you have this amazing amount of information and skill that you can bring to the party. The question is, how are you going to get the right invite?
Yes. Yeah, that's it. So I've learned that networks are crucial, and thankfully my networks here in Scotland are good. Obviously they can always be improved, but they're good as a result of my time with Scottish Development International. I'm grateful for that. Obviously working with Russell Dalgleish at the Scottish Business Network has been another step in the right direction, and of course the Scottish Business Network are tied in with the Institute of Directors here in Scotland. So those networks are starting to look quite good and varied. And it's being active and getting out there and having conversations. And to be honest, the conversation I referred to, the negotiation I referred to earlier on that I'm having with a client in the Middle East, that's come around as a result of my time in the Middle East. I've reconnected with someone out there who's fairly senior in an organization out there, and we're having a conversation that may lead to something quite interesting at the beginning of the year. So it's really just working those networks and working with people who know your experience, who can see value in what you have. It's very difficult to do that starting from a zero base. You're talking to someone who doesn't know you. That's really, really tough. But you know, it's one of those things. You just need to get out there and do that.
With my marketing hat on, it's, you know, you've got to get three stages in place. They've got to know you, like you, and trust you.
Yes, know you, like you, trust you. I get it. That's the thing. And so logically, to try and shorten the road to the pathway to your next opportunity, you kind of go with people who know you. And that's okay if you've got a reasonably wide base, and I'm not too badly off there, but you always need to start developing new relationships. And so it's a two stroke approach, I suppose.
The other challenge I suspect you will have, and I'm sorry to say this to you, but the point is, when you work for the government, the bills are paid. And so going to a company and offering these services, they don't actually need to pay you because the bills are paid. But as an independent, you got to be funded. Yes. That makes the relationship very different.
It does, but I don't think it differs the value that you can deliver.
It doesn't change the value at all, but it just changes the perception of the relationship.
It absolutely does. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I'm sure that that's something that I will confront and have to adapt to. The bottom line here is I've got lots of experience. I've done a vast array of jobs within enterprise and economic development in the international sphere, whether it's international trade outbound, or looking for JVs and partnerships overseas, or seeking to bring inward investment in from corporations into the UK and specifically Scotland. So I can work across that piece. I think I've learned enough in that to know that I can do that confidently. It's how you package that and then point at the right potential client.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing. You just need to get started. You just need to take that first step. And I think it'll be like, you know, getting back on the bike again and off you go. But you do realize, I think there's more chance of me delivering real value when you're working more intensely for one or two clients rather than spread across a range.
The time frame will be shorter as well. You'll be doing projects in much shorter time frames rather than 3 or 4 years, because
yes, that's right, task and finish. You know, you'll be working, you know, you could deal with hundreds of clients in a 3-year appointment in China or India or in the Middle East, but actually over the course of 6 months you might be dealing with one client only and delivering specifically for that one client. I get the sense that that could be more rewarding because you'd be much more focused on that client. The client will be able to kind of get more out of you, as it were. And that,
well, there will you will be more involved in the project rather than being the meet and greet stuff. You'll be doing the meet and greet stuff, and you'll be doing the next bit as well, probably, because that's what they're paying you for. So yeah.
And you won't have a cast of thousands to help you deliver.
You'll be the one doing the bits and pieces as well. I think it's going to be an interesting transition for you, because I made that. It's interesting because I worked for a local enterprise here when I first moved to Scotland. And when the financial crash hit, a lot of the services that were being provided, where I could just walk in and offer people help, were taken away. And people still needed the help. But when I turned around and said, well, you're going to have to pay me now, they went, well, no, I think we'll struggle on our own. That's all right.
Yes, and I think there's that, I wouldn't say typifies, but it's an expression of the culture that I think we've got here in Scotland, where there's far less of a desire to pay for things. And I don't mean that to make it sound tight, but I think, you know, we don't see the value in actually, back to the conversation I had earlier, if you want to double your turnover in a new international market within the next 2 or 3 years, then you need to put down a slab of resource at the front end and say, that's my commitment to make that happen. You know, and work at it. And I don't think there's that level of commitment here in Scotland. And it puzzles me as to why that is. It's partly cultural.
It's just Scotland. I think we, because of the internet and because of the way that information now is a currency, I think people have got used to getting information for free. So to be honest, Tom, there's nothing that you could tell anybody that they couldn't actually find out for themselves. Mm-hmm. The difference is they don't have the skill or the capacity to pack it in the right way. And then here's the one thing they don't have, is they don't have the drive to implement it all properly. So when they pay someone like you to do it for them, then, you know, for starters, they've got some skin in the game. Some money has changed hands. Like, and they're now feeling a bit antsy about the fact that this is going to cost them. So therefore, they do the work. And that's the difference, really.
Yeah, it's a commitment, isn't it?
And when you go into companies and try and do things that the government's footing the bill for, there's a, well, look, I mean, yeah, it's great. I love the service, but, you know, there's a fire over here I need to sort out.
Yes. And I think I've come across that many, many times, and it's quite frustrating because it doesn't inspire that 100% commitment to the task at hand and working hard to make that turnover increase in that market in that period of time. So I'm starting to get those insights, Paul, which is interesting. And perhaps you and I could have a conversation offline about what that might mean and share experiences.
I think it might be an interesting journey. So, okay, Tom, look, I would love to unpack some more of this conversation, because I think I'm really getting into some of that. And I'd love to hear about China and those bits and pieces. I think there's some good stories in there, but I'm also conscious of time. So I need to kind of start bringing this to a conclusion a little bit. So tell me, Tom, is there anything that I should have asked you about that I didn't?
I guess, I mean, I can bore you with 101 war stories of my time in India and China, and those would be exciting to recount and perhaps well received, but they might prove a little kind of boring for people listening to this podcast. thing you should have asked me about, what my favorite market and why.
Okay, what's your favorite market and why?
I think I would always go for the excitement of where people bring a place to life. And in South America, in Venezuela, that was very true. But economically, it was very stilted. And we're going back here to the early 90s, very early 90s, in fact. And that was at a time when that market, Venezuela, was regarded as starting to show signs of doing quite well. And we all know what's happened over there since then. I would have to go, therefore, for somewhere like India, which is vast. And we lived in an old ramshackle house, not very far away from the British High Commission in New Delhi. And we used to drive in every morning, and it was fascinating. It was like being in a film set, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the colors. It was, you truly were in a different place than I'd ever been before. And I've gone on to China after that, and I went on to the Middle East after that. And I would still say that India just captures the heart, the imagination. It gets under the skin. It really does, in a good way. And we've been back two or three times since then. And whilst things have developed and there's obviously more wealth there now and people are driving bigger, flashier cars, the intrinsic Indian spirit hasn't changed. It still exists. And I think that is the one thing that sticks with you. And we've been so privileged to have seen it. So as a market, and of course, you know, from a commercial point of view, India really is starting to move. It's like that train that's just left the station and it's yet to build up a head of steam. It's not got there yet, and it might not get there for some years and maybe even decades yet. But when it starts to really roll, it will really start to roll. And I think that's quite exciting. And yeah, India would be my place.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, so you have this amazing range of skills, and I'm sure there are people listening to this podcast that could use them. Who is it? Who is your ideal client? Who should be getting in touch with you?
Clearly, I would like to speak to any company who has the commitment, who can see the size of the prize in an overseas market, who's done a little research and is wondering how to unpack what they see. Someone who's committed, a company who's committed to exporting goods and services or to finding that partner in any of the regions which I've worked in, someone who's committed. It needs to be someone who's prepared to do a bit of graft and prepared to leave the office and get on a plane and fly to wherever and spend a bit of time there and talk in serious terms about next stages. Somebody who's prepared to commit the resources to make something happen. That would be the classic client. And that's at one end of the scale. At the other end of the scale, as I say, I'm working with, or I'm about to be working with, larger corporations who are looking for some guidance and insight on inward investment. So the first bit of that conversation was about trade, people looking to, organizations looking to trade outbound, but also larger organizations who are looking to drag in inbound investment.
Well, this podcast has quite a wide audience across the world, as it happens. You never know who might turn up. And we'll put the details how to connect with you on the podcast website, I think. I mean, is there an obvious way to connect with you? Is it LinkedIn? Is it something like that?
I think the obvious way is LinkedIn. Yeah, my profile's up to date. I'm on there. People can reach me through that. Please do. Happy to talk to anyone.
And do you have a website? Do you have a website as yet?
It's being built as we speak, not yet, but close.
Okay, so what we'll do, we'll put those details, as I said, we'll put those details on the podcast details, so we're there.
Great.
So here we are. We approach the end of our time together, and there's this thing about that I ask all of my guests on here, which it's a kind of one question which everyone kind of, I don't know if they're looking forward to it or not really, but look, okay, we arrive on this earth as children, we grow and we are effectively animals on this earth. We grow, we meet other children, we meet adults, we become, you know, we grow up, we have children, we have this whole process right the way to the end and we leave the earth. What is the meaning of life for you? Why are we here?
I'm not going to come up with the answer 42. I'm sure that's been done before.
Oh, God, that's been done so many times, 42.
In which
case... I had a conversation yesterday on a podcast about 42.
I think the sensible answer is just to make your way in this world. Create waves, by all means, and even if it's just ripples, as long as you're remembered well by people, as someone who had the right intentions, and... I think raising a family is absolutely key to that. I know it sounds a bit prosaic, but there you go. It's something that I had never really thought about 15 years ago, and all of a sudden we had kind of back-to-back kids. There's only 17 months between my two boys. It's looking at how they're learning and what they're learning and where they're learning it. In my instance, obviously overseas, one born in India, one born in China. I'm a product of my generation, I suppose, the globalization of the world.
Does that mean they have citizenship in those countries?
It means that they have a visa right, so they will not need a visa to enter those markets, which is great. They just get a carnet and they'll be able to zip through the border at Hong Kong and hopefully China, if ever gets integrated, and obviously India too, which is fantastic for their international careers,
wow,
should they choose to go that way. So yeah, I think it's just about that. It's about, you know, love your family, love what you do, and if you don't love what you do, you need to think about changing what you do.
Yeah, good point. Good answer. So Tom Marchbanks, thank you very much for your time today. It has been a great conversation, and I've really enjoyed hearing the inside background to this world that you live in.
Paul, it's been lovely. Thank you for the opportunity. And I look forward to the chance and opportunity to get to speak to you again. All the best.
All the best, mate. All the best. And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Tom Marchbanks. As ever, his details will be on the podcast page at the website. As you will have heard on the program, Tom is now a freelance international trade and investment advisor. He can bring his skills and, I suspect, contact list to your export ambitions. So if you have export ambitions in US, in UK, wherever, connect with Tom. I'm sure he can help you. And that is the end of today's show. I want to send a personal thank you to you for your listening, because I really appreciate your time and attention. Every week we are seeing new listeners, and that is down to you sharing and liking these programs. If you have questions or comments, you can use the podcast app to reach out to me, or you can reach out on Facebook or LinkedIn. I'm very easy to find. Although if you do Google me, you will likely find that other Paul Harvey, the newsman of the 1970s, and he gets everywhere. He must have been very popular. Anyway, thank you for your time and attention, as I've already said, and I will catch you next time.